Thank you for listening to the Impact Leaders Podcast, featuring leaders focusing on sustainable and impact investment and performance with purpose, sharing their stories, experiences, and advice to increase awareness in the market and highlight best practices in order to help more companies and institutions transition more capital into the industry faster. I'm JP Dalman, founder and CEO of ILM Partners. I am grateful that you're choosing to invest your time in doing this, since I know that you're going to feel encouraged and inspired. Make sure you subscribe to get the notifications from your preferred podcast platform. And do follow us on social media to stay connected. We appreciate your support. It helps keep Impact Leaders going. Enjoy this episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Impact Leaders. In today's episode of Impact Leaders, we have Mr. Saka Nusseibeh, CBE, as our guest. Hello, Saka.
Hi.
Welcome. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's very kind.
It's a real honor. It has been a long time coming, so I'm personally very excited, and I'm sure that everyone's going to listen to the episode as well. And I just so that people can imagine about us and where we are, you know, I tend to ask people where they are. So today you are in London.
That's right. And I'm sitting in my house, in fact, in a spare room where I work. But you see behind me a picture of my office. And there are two things that tells you the picture is fake. One is that the time is wrong, if you look at the clock. And the second one is, to get this picture, you'd have to imagine I'm actually sitting on my desk facing the back wall, rather than looking out from my desk where I normally look at. But you get to see bit of St. Paul's, and it means that you don't see the mess behind me in my room.
Yes, very good. And you were sharing with me that you were just coming back from Spain as well, so we catch you fresh.
Yeah, I was very lucky, and what a wonderful place it is.
Very nice. Spain. Very nice. So as an introduction to the podcast, I share a short bio by yourself, so that people that do not know you get the benefit to have a bit of the background. So I will quickly read this introduction. So Mr. Saka Nusseibeh is CEO of the international business of Federated Hermes, appointed November 2011, and he joined in June 2009 as CIO, Chief Investment Officer. He's also a member of the Federated Hermes executive team. Prior to this, Mr. Nusseibeh was Global Head of Equities at Fortis Investments, having previously been CIO Global Equities since 2005. And before this, he was CIO of Global Equities and Head of Marketing for SGAM UK. This followed the acquisition of Trust Company of the West, where Saka was Managing Director running global and international strategies, as well as the London office. He started his career at Mercury Asset Management back in 1987. He's founder of the 300 Club and was an inaugural member of the CFA Institute's Future for Finance Advisory Council from 2013 and 2019. He's a member of the IIRC Council, the FCA PRA Climate Financial Risk Forum, the United Nations Environmental Programme Financial Initiative Steering Committee, the Banking Standards Board, the UK National Advisory Board on Impact Investing, and the Advisory Board of the National Youth Orchestra. In 2018, Mr. Nusseibeh was named CEO of the Year at the Financial News Asset Management Europe Awards. He has a BA and PhD in Medieval History from King's College, University of London. And finally, very proudly, he was awarded CBE Commander of the Order of the British Empire in the Queen's 2019 New Year's Honours List for services to responsible business and finance. Very good. Congratulations on that last point.
Thank you very much. I'm very proud of it. Thank you.
Very, very nice. I mean, you have done so much in your career, which is spanning now, what is it? No,
33 years.
Yeah, 33 years. Fascinating. And there is so much more that is not including here. We could read, I guess, another page at least. Is there anything that I should add to that?
None, I think, other than to say that I'm very lucky. I joined asset management when it wasn't quite the established business it is today. And I've seen it come through a huge period of change and development. And in this, I've been incredibly fortunate, as I say.
Yeah, very nice. And I think we'll talk about your history a little bit more as well later, but you know, I think I may as well add here that I think you came to England when you were 15, so actually, and to study, you know, and then from that on, you have become fully British.
Absolutely right. So I came twice. I came with my parents when I was 4, and we left when I was 6 or 7, and then I came again when I was 15, and I never left. And so I've been British since then, and I'm almost 60 now. So that's been, I've lived here longer than I've lived anywhere else, if you calculate.
Yeah, the same as me now. So as it is our tradition, our first question to all our guests is, you know, what is a sustainable and impact investing?
So I think I can say easier what is not sustainable investing, and then we'll come into impact investing. So sustainable investing is the investing that makes sense over the long term. And what it really means, it's an investment that works over a time horizon that is shorter than 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years. And if you are going to invest over the long term, and most investments should be about the long term, then sustainability are the key metrics that would make it a successful financial investment. Now, these include the obvious things like the sustainability of the business plan, the sustainability of the financial plan, and so on. But it has other metrics, which we understand within the ESG universe. So the social impact, what does social impact mean in terms of sustainability? It means that your business within the community it works in is welcomed and liked, and therefore the regulator, the community, doesn't actually put onerous regulation against you. What does sustainability in terms of your stakeholders mean? Well, it means that you look after your workforce and the culture within your organization, so you give resilience to your organization and you have higher productivity. What does sustainability of your business proposition for your customers mean? Well, it means that you make sure that actually you're giving them something that they need and want at a price that is fair to you. What is sustainability for your shareholders? It means that you build wealth over a very long time rather than a jagged edge of wealth that you take it out. So all of these things come within sustainable. To my mind, no investment that is an active long-term investment can be anything other than a sustainable investment. And to say further, we all know about the ESG. I cannot see how you can be an investor in the long term and not integrate ESG. So that's sustainability. Impact is a little bit different. Impact is where, in addition to the normal business practice, you're trying to specifically have a targeted impact of your investment. That could be, for example, trying to have an impact on a community. You could do that in public markets and you could do that in private markets. In our own firm, I'd argue that our placemaking projects where we develop inner city areas like King's Cross have a meaningful impact on the community by providing them with new space, by providing a new space for the whole community of London, by providing employment for a poor part of the country and regenerating it. Or it could be impact in the sense of investing in things that then have an impact on consumer habits, for example, making them more carbon neutral. So this is the two differences between the two.
Very good, very good. And I know that technically as well, you know, we talk about ethical investment and responsible investment, but I did pick up, I think, one of the many interviews that you give that, you know, you do talk about sustainable investing is, you know, being responsible about how we go about doing things, right? So, and I like making a difference, and I think that I share with you this, you know, bigger conversation around sustainability and then the specifics about impact. And then I like as well that the fact that everything is being responsible.
And it kind of makes sense. So one of the things that I like saying is that being good is good business. I think when we invest, we sort of forget why we invest, right? So bear with me. And I know we haven't prepared this in our previous discussion, but actually it's an interesting one.
Yeah.
Why is it that we invest? What's the purpose of it, right? If you ask people in my business, they'll say to you, oh, well, we're trying to beat a benchmark. But that's just a heuristic. Or they'll say, we're trying to create a pot for the investor that at the end of the 30 years will pay cash flow. But that also is a heuristic. In reality, the reason that we invest for the long term is because we want to, when we stop working, retire well. That's what we want. Mm. And then as a shorthand for retire well, we say that means that we have to have enough money to live well. But that's just a shorthand. What we mean is we want to live well in an environment that we like. Well, if the world is 3 degrees warmer, it ain't a nice environment. We mean in a society that is cohesive and not fractured. Well, that means that it has to be one that doesn't have fractures built within it in an inequitable way. It means that I want to make sure that my children and my grandchildren, I don't have grandchildren, but I want to have my children, certainly for now, have equal employment opportunities. That's where inclusion and diversity comes in. I want them to be treated fairly by their companies. What I'm saying is, I want to live in a better world that I can retire in, and I want my money to get me to that world. And in the same way that I use my tax money to try to tell governments what I'd like to do in society, I can also use my investment money to build the world that I'd like to retire in. And it turns out that if I do that, and this is where the sustainability argument, if I do behave responsibly, it turns out actually financially I'm better off and my retirement is better off. And that's why responsible investment makes sense, because we don't live in an isolated bubble called the financial world. We live in the real world, in real communities, with real neighbors, in the real state.
Yes, yes. And I think it's great. And I do remember that conversation and that presentation you were giving, I think it was over the summer. And you mentioned, I think, Adam Smith and the philosophy. I know that you talk about capitalism and the control of capital, and in the past episodes, you know, have been, you know, talking about that. So I think maybe that's another way that maybe you can share with us, you know, what is your view of, you know, the past philosophers, the past ideas, you know, capitalism and this, you know, responsibility that we have as investors.
So it's an interesting one. Let me again paint the background picture. So if you think about it, we, of the income that we earn, depending on how much tax you pay, we give away a big chunk of our earnings effectively to governments in taxation. And we believe that we have the right, and that's correct, to choose how the governments use that money to shape the world that we live in. But actually the companies we work in and the companies that we own through our savings, about 80 trillion of assets if you put the developed world savings, control the other half that the government does not control, the private sector, right? Because you have 80 trillion that's direct investment, and then that includes ownership in banks and private equities and firms and so on that actually generate capital. So in reality, we control most of the capital market of the world. So we have the ability to shape the world in a way that is beneficial to us. And I want to come back to what beneficial to us means. Mm-hmm. But that power is enormous, and it can help shape what sort of returns we have and what sort of society we have. And that's where you want to have responsibility. There is a mistaken view, I think, by many, that the only purpose of the free market system is simply to make more money for the sake of making more money. It's actually based on a misunderstanding of what the Chicago School and Friedman said. He didn't quite say that, but people misunderstand, and that's what they say. And they often refer to Adam Smith, the father of free market economics, as being the person who perpetrated that. Actually, the way the free market works is that each one of us, being rational and selfish, they say, that's not what he said, but that's what the people think he said, we'll act in our own self-interest, and then somehow the market finds an equilibrium which is best for all. Now, I want to challenge this, and I'm glad you brought this up, because generally speaking, people in our business do not read old stuff as much as they should. And so they tend to read sort of summaries. Mm-hmm. And people tend not to have read Adam Smith's earlier works. They forget that Adam Smith was a moral philosopher. And the main book he wrote is The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And it preceded his book on markets. And this is what he says about the self-interested man. I'm afraid he was a first time, so he didn't say person, he said man. So I will stick with the gender inequality that he put in. But he says about the self-interested person, he's sensible to that his own interest is connected with the prosperity of society. Notice, not his own wealth, but the wealth of the whole of society. And that the happiness, perhaps the preservation of his existence, again, odd, right? His contentment, happiness here means contentment. The preservation of his existence, his very life depends upon what? Its preservation. Preserving what? The prosperity of society. So actually, Adam Smith is saying something entirely different. He's saying it's in our own self-interest to make sure that the society we live in is prosperous. He talks about fairness, again, talking about the way that people understand fairness. And he says, for example, upon every account, therefore, he has an abhorrence at whatever can tend to destroy society and is willing to make use of every means which can hinder so hated and so dreadful an event. Again, it's community-based. Talks about justice. All men, even the most stupid and unthinking, abhor fraud, perfidy, and injustice and delight to see them punished. Few have reflected upon the necessity of justice to the existence of society, how obvious soever that necessity might appear to be. So here we have supposedly the father of the free market concept saying to us, for that to work, actually, morally, we have to look to the happiness of the society around us. And in fact, if you strip that back and you say this responsibility, this moral outlook on how you should behave, it turns out, in fact, to be connected with the best possible way to behave to maximize your returns anyway. So there is a misconception out there that somehow by following a responsible path, by following a sustainable path, you are giving up financial gain. And my answer to that is, this is simply not true. In fact, by sticking to the responsible path, by integrating sustainability into what you do and other factors of ESG and stewardship, what you end up doing is maximizing your financial return and building a better society, because the two are connected. And that's where people, I think, have lost sight of where we are. And why have they lost sight? And maybe you wanted me to come to that later, but this difference between investing and gambling, which I think is a really interesting idea. So if you listen to the way that, particularly in the last 10, 15 years, people talk about markets, we use terminology associated with casinos and betting. We are betting on our stocks. We are betting the market is going to go up. We are betting that inflation is going to be better. Even the way that we represent markets in the media is a little bit like people talking about horse racing. So you have people talking about, you know, and the markets have opened and they're up a few bips and they're down a few bips. Now, if you step back, actually, you notice two things. One is, it doesn't matter over the long term, because it's the long term trend that matters. And people tend to forget that. And you can do a thought experiment. If you lived in the UK and you had all your wealth in a portfolio, which was simply the index, and it switched off the screen in 2007 and went away and came back again in 2015, 16, and switched the screen on again, you'd have thought nothing had happened, right?
Right.
Which is an interesting concept. Of course, a lot had happened, and we'll come back to that, because that's to do with responsible investing, by the way. But the other thing that people have done is, there's been a lot of academic work trying to work out what people are good at. And it turns out that people who bet on markets, essentially, are bad at making returns. And studies show that the best amongst them, the best, maybe give 30% chance of hitting, outperforming the markets, right? The buy low, sell high mentality, 30%. Now, there have been also studies about professional poker players in Las Vegas who play in the big poker games. Their hit ratio is 56, 57%. So actually, rationally, if the only purpose of investing is simply to make money with no other impact, then what you really should do is not bet on the market, but go to Las Vegas, hire a poker player and give him or her your money, because that's a better way of making money. But of course, that's nonsense, because the reason you invest is you want to grow the economy that you want to live in. That's the first one. And then let's go back to this thing about, you know, what is the purpose of investing and why it is a mistake to think about the long, you know, the markets have done nothing between 2008 and 2007. Because every investment you make has an impact on your life, not just on your portfolio, but on your life. So the investments you made in banks in the run-up to 2008 might have looked really good investments between 2003, 2004, 2008. The correction of the market by 2016, 17 might have looked as if you've made your money back, but you haven't, because the GDP loss and the extra debt was taken on by this country in the United Kingdom as a result of that crash means that each one of us as citizens have an additional £16,000 of debt hanging on us because of that. So when you calculate your returns and when you think about sustainability, you have to think in terms of the total impact of your investment on how you're going to live your life. And that's why we talk about holistic returns rather than purely financial returns.
Yes, I like all the different areas that you touch upon, because I do try to, you know, for anyone and everyone that listens to these conversations, you know, I do like the kind of the macro concept so that people understand what things are happening and affecting, you know, the market and then affecting our lives. And I think that during the points that you made, you can make people understand and be aware of how everything affects everyone in one way or another. And I like the, how you put it at the end, you know, that specific 16K debt hanging on each one of us. You know, I think that, you know, what people struggle sometimes to understand is how all the different parts, you know, come together and affect, you know, one another, right? And I personally asked you that question because I thought when you talked about it, that presentation in the summer, that was, you know, very, very interesting to see the kind of interpretation, you know, that people can make on the loss, you know, the loss of economy or the invisible hand, et cetera, and how then it becomes, you know, a reality. And then one last point, and we'll continue with other points, but it was when you mentioned that if you, you know, went away in 2007, I think you mentioned, then came back. Maybe, and you do talk about this in a few conversations as well, is maybe on financial terms, you know, your portfolio and your bank account will look like, you know, actually it's been a really good, you know, decade plus, right? But there are other factors and other things that have changed completely. And that's, I think, the point that, at least that's my perception and my feeling right now, that before now and before the last, you know, couple of years, especially this year, of course, there was still, and I'm going to use a big word here, almost like a sense of immortality of the world, that all that mattered was to make money, because the more wealth you have, not the better off you are, and the more you can enjoy life. But then all of a sudden we have the reality that, you know, you cannot really enjoy anything if you cannot even move around, you know, the world, right? Which was a kind of the big ice bucket, you know, in 2020. So, yeah. So, if I may,
COVID is also interesting in another way, which is it generated a debate, right? Which is an interesting debate, which is what do we as developed societies care about? And it particularly is within developed societies, much more developing.
What is priority?
We care about the life of all citizens, including, by the way, citizens who are not economically productive. I mean, that's what pensioners are in harsh economic terms, right? Yes. Do we care about citizens' lives, or do we care just about pure financial economic growth? Now, societies have chosen that we care about all citizens. In some parts of the world, perhaps more reluctantly than others, because there's a tension. But by and large, most people kind of instinctively veered towards that. And I would argue that's because Adam Smith got it right when he said, looking at people, at mankind, there is an imperative, in fact, to look after your community. That is inbuilt in us. He argues, in fact, it's actually inbuilt in us as human beings. And that is how free market societies should work. And we've simply forgotten.
Very good point. So thank you so much for those initial reflections. I think that is something that I think people will find very valuable, if anything, just to rethink about how they are operating and investing from their own values. And talking about values, let me quickly just talk about what you are doing and as CEO and with your company. So about your company, let me just give a quick introduction. And I do recommend to people, we did an interview with a former colleague of yours, Mr. Parry, in the past. So we talked at length as well about Hermes at that time, which was a slightly different make. But now, basically, we have Federated Hermes, a global leader in active, responsible investment, and is guided by the conviction that responsible investing is the way to create long-term wealth. You provide specialized capabilities across equity, fixed income, and private markets, in addition to multi-asset strategies and liquidity management solutions. And through your pioneering stewardship services, you engage companies on strategic and sustainability concerns to promote investors' long-term performance and fiduciary interests. And it says that your goals are to help, as you mentioned before, individuals invest and retire better, help clients achieve better risk-adjusted returns, and to contribute to positive outcomes in the wider world. And in 2019, there was a significant event since I think Federated Investors acquired a majority stake. So all activities previously carried out by Hermes Investment Management now form the international business of Federated Hermes. And there's some more specifics around when you rebrand there as well, but I'll stop there for now. So the question here is like, what else can you tell us about your company and what is it that you're doing, you know, on the back of everything that we discussed in the introduction?
So let me break down to three things, actually, if I may. The first thing, I want to tell you who we are.
Yes.
And then what we do.
Yes.
And then why the merger was such a unique merger in the history, or acquisition, in fact. It's not a merger, it's an acquisition in the history of this merger. So the first one is who we are. And people talk about companies like, you know, again, this idea that we live in silos. A company is simply a collection of people.
Right, yeah.
Men and women coming together, essentially, to work together. So who we are is about who we as a team are as human beings. And we are a group of people who have come together because we have a shared set of values. And we have a shared assumption. The shared assumption that we have is that it's possible in the financial sector to combine being really technically excellent at what you do, while at the same time being truly a decent human being. We call it being nice. Mm-hmm. And that's why for years, we've been paying half our bonuses to employees, including myself, based on behaviors, not just on profitability or on technical achievement. So that's what we want to be. In terms of the shared values, we are all aware that people in finance forget who the end owner of all the assets that we manage are. And typically speaking, that person, if they live in the developed world, will retire with a pot at the end of the day of about 300 to 500,000 pounds or dollars, which will give them an income of about 13 to 15, maybe 18,000 pounds a year. That's it. And within that, what we do with their money to build the retirement pot and the world we create for them matters. So the impact of our investment echoes. And we have to understand, in many ways, the law of small numbers, mm-hmm. not just the law of big numbers. People in my business often talk, we run 500 billion, we yeah. run a billion, we run the... Yeah, 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 but our clients at the end of the retirement pot are going to have 500,000. The rich ones, a couple of million. And if you take that into a monthly income, it's not trillions. And keep that in mind, because if you think about what the world is going to be like, you have to make sure that that amount gives them a happy, a content retirement. And to achieve that, we believe the way to do it is to behave responsibly. And that, to our mind, means two things. One is to be long-term, whatever you do, not short-term, not but investing. And the other one is to integrate both ESG and stewardship in what we do. Why do we believe in high active share? Because actually that means that we differentiate our investment. We concentrate on companies that we can have long-term relationships with. Why do we believe in stewardship, our EOS business? Because we believe we have to have long-term conversations with companies that doesn't say to them, I don't like your business, I'm going to sell you, or you haven't achieved next quarter's results, I'm going to sell you. Much more about, we are in this for the next 10, 15 years together. Let's talk about how to make this a sustainable wealth creation exercise. And we think to do that, you achieve outcomes which are outside the norm. And we separate ourselves, if you like, from those around us in two ways. The first one is, to my knowledge, we're the only asset management company that has a personal pledge by every person who joins us mm-hmm. that talks about things other than just making money for the firm. All the things you'd expect us to talk about that we should be talking about as an industry, putting the interests of our clients before our own profitability, for example, being open and transparent with all, advocating for the environment, giving back to the community that we live in. That's part of being within this wider community. And that, I think, differentiated us. And at the same time, we, as you mentioned at the beginning, have always been pioneer in what we've done. So we've integrated ESG before everybody else did. We effectively invented the stewardship business, EOS. Now we have more than a trillion of assets under management. And we are moving into impact. We were there at the beginning with stuff on impact in private markets and then in public markets and so on. Now, what's unique about the sale to Federated Hermes? We were 100% owned by the BT pension scheme. We started off as the in-house manager of the BT pension scheme. And it became clear to the management team, our management team, that as the BT pension scheme matures, we should, at the end of the day, move out and find another set of owners. So we went out and we looked for another set of owners. We found that potential buyers came down into three categories. There was a sort of buyer who just wanted to buy our book of business. And these people, by the way, were not interested in what we do. They just wanted to buy the book of business. That is typical of a lot of M&A activity management. We found there were some buyers who wanted a strategic footprint in Europe, particularly North American guys. Okay, they were interested generically in us, but not in us specifically. And there were very few buyers who wanted us because of our skill set. And the one who was closest to us in terms of culture and aspiration was Federated out of Pittsburgh. And it was an extraordinary marriage of culture. And why did they buy us? They did not buy us because we have equity. I mean, if you look at our assets under management, we have about 30, 35 billion pounds. It doesn't really move the needle for them as much as another acquisition might have done. But what they were buying was our IP, if you like, our knowledge of integrating ESG. And so the first thing we did post-2018 is we built a responsibility office in Pittsburgh, identical to the one we have in London. And we are unique in having something like the responsibility office, which is pari passu with the CIO office that is responsible for integrating ESG and for integrating stewardship. We built that over there. We expanded our EOS business. So this is, to my mind, the first time that there's an acquisition in the asset management business at scale that's equivalent to this, that's purely buying IP. But not any IP, purely buying responsible investment IP. That's an extraordinary thing to have done. And I'm very pleased with the acquisition, and I'm very proud to be part of the team that helped make Hermes, and I'm very proud to be part of Federated Hermes as a bigger team, because actually we're now a bigger group of people who believe the same thing. And I will say one thing about the brand. Typically, when a company acquires another in our business, the acquired company, the one that's been acquired in its own local market, becomes, if it's called, for example, Delman Asset Management, it'll become, you know, let's make it up, it'll become Saka Delman Asset Management. And if Saka is the company back, the acquirer, after a while, the one that's been acquired becomes, you know, it goes Saka Delman Asset Management, and then suddenly you drop the Delman. This is an odd acquisition, because what happened was Federated Hermes acquired us, and they were called Federated. They changed their name to Federated Hermes. Why? Because they're signaling to the market that this is a merger of culture. And to do that, and before they did that, they ensured two things. One is that ESG has been integrated in the vast majority of the portfolios by the time we did the change. Secondly, that the employees had signed the exact same pledge that we have. Notice, it's the personal pledge. We're not talking about books of business. We're not talking about sales capabilities. We're talking about values. We signed the same pledge. And that then brought us together into this Federated Hermes, which then becomes the leader in ESG integration. So it's a story of values and people, not of finance and books. But it turns out it's a way of making more money too.
Yes, very nice. And we were saying before, just, you know, they say every person I meet in your company, you know, is an outstanding individual and professional. And so I can attest, you know, for what you're saying. You know, we were talking about Andrew Parry before, and Tim Crockford, and Hans Christoph Hurd from the EOS business as well. And everyone's very special. And it's interesting, because I think that a couple of notes, you know, that and interviews and articles as well that people wrote about you. And I think there was one where they mentioned an FT about this oath that you actually proposed to the whole market, you know, should take on, you know, a bit of comparing to like that oath of the doctors, you know, and trying to make people understand on the investment side that, you know, there is a real duty and responsibility. So it's a very interesting point. And I do want to come back just a little bit. I don't want to make this a conversation about acquisition, but I think that some of the other CEOs will appreciate your insight. But I was going to ask you, what does nice look like, you know, when you talk about being nice, you know, because, you know, it sounds very nice, but, you know, if I am the CEO of a company that is trying to add kind of the non-financial points to performance reviews, and I know that many of the banks specifically, you know, have gone into adding the how we behave to the, you know, annual and quarterly reviews. But can you give just any one example perhaps that can help people imagine what that is?
So it's an interesting one, because my head of HR, Martin Jackson, who's a friend and actually worked with me in a previous company before I brought him to this company, always says to me that nice is vague and how do you market nice? I mean, the technicality is we market according to our pledge. So the pledge is made up of various statements that we make as an individual, and we assign it, and there's a direct correlation between one to the other. If you want to boil it down, it comes down to very simple precepts. The first one is the idea that you behave ethically, essentially. That's the whole relationship with the client. You behave ethically. You understand that you're simply a servant of the pensioners whose money you run, and that this is a trust, and it's an extraordinary trust. And this, both we and Federated shared. They have a history of being good fiduciaries. We came at it from looking after the beneficiaries' money. The second one is that you treat everyone around you with respect and dignity. Now, people talk about treating people with respect and dignity, but in hierarchies, generally speaking, people tend to be less concerned with people who are less powerful, less well off than them. Mm. It's a lot of emphasis.
Unconscious bias as well, yeah.
And unconscious bias. We put a huge amount of effort on inclusion and on sensitivity, and I'm going to come back to that, if I may. And then the third one is an understanding that we are privileged. We really are privileged in two ways. First, we're privileged in the job that we do, and that privilege should not be wasted. If you have power, if you have authority, you should have the responsibility that goes with authority. And so that's why we are always innovating how we could use this power in finding better ways to invest in ways that are better for everybody. And the second one is we're privileged because of how much we get paid and where we are, and that we should therefore reach out and help those around us. It has always been, I mean, you can see St. Paul, for those of you who can see the video behind me.
Yes.
And the city of London is the richest borough in the country. But right next to us is Tower Hamlets, and that's one of the poorest boroughs in the country. Now, lots of people write checks, and there's nothing wrong with writing checks. But one of the ways that we, in fact, judge whether you're being nice or not is how much you give of your own time to help people in the area that you live in and so on. And we do this in a variety of ways. We encourage people, for example, from our executive staff to go and give children from the private schools one-on-one lessons in either maths or English or another subject that they need to be helped with. We encourage executives who are female to go and to give talks to young girls to get them to understand that they do have opportunities if they want to grab them. Recently, post Mr. Floyd's death in the United States, we've instigated a program. We've joined the programs that the city is doing. The city, there's a program that's been launched by the man who runs Reddington, who's a friend, and that's called the 100 Interns in the city. That's good, but we think that goes to people who come from university. We've got our own, we've joined that, but we've done something else as well. We've started our own program of going to essentially schools, colleges and schools, and addressing young people from our colleagues in the Black community who would not necessarily want to go to university for understandable reasons, and trying to offer them a way in by teaching them on the job and giving them CFAs. So this is something we've done. So how much are you giving of your time? Time is more precious than money, right? And how much do you empathize? And let me come back to the whole issue about Mr. Floyd's death and then the anger that did. I'm sure other people did the same, but I'll tell you what we did. And that sort of reflects who we are. We had an open conversation on an open line with something like 250 colleagues participating. Our total numbers, by the way, are 400. So 250 colleagues participated. We had a totally frank and open discussion about unconscious bias, about prejudice. We had Black colleagues describe to everybody what their daily life is like, what they feel, how they feel towards their colleagues. We had colleagues apologizing to colleagues online. And it's important because we come back, when I started talking to you about us as a firm, and I said, it's not what we do, it's who we are.
Yes.
Who we are then produces what we do. But you start with the human first, not the product.
It sounds like people are embodying, you know, the values and the oath, right? Yeah. You're helping them with specific actions and plans.
And all of us hope, at least some of us, and I think all of us hope, that we see ourselves as a pebble. If you look at the mountainside, before there is an avalanche, there's a little pebble that starts coming down the scree, right? And then the pebble makes other pebbles follow, and then the pebbles becomes rocks, and then the rocks means the whole thing falls down. So we see ourselves as a pebble that maybe can help start the avalanche, that maybe can change the market for better. That's how we see ourselves. And I think we are part of that movement. I don't say we made that movement, but I'd say we are helping that movement. So going back to the oath or the pledge, in 2015, colleagues in the investment as a business said to me, it's a wonderful thing, but we can't as a business come out and say it for a variety of reasons. Things have moved now. If I were to ask the exact same colleagues today, would you want us as a business, as an industry to sign this pledge? I'm pretty certain most of them would say yes. Now that's happened because the consumers moved, societies moved, times have changed. And I hope that we were partly responsible as the little pebble of moving the boulders that may change. The key is to make change for the better, right?
Yes, and start, right? Very good. And going back to, like we're going from the pounds to the millions to the trillions, but just for context, and I picked up a couple of numbers, you know, from past articles and from your website. But so if I picked up correctly, so back in 2018, it was, I think, just pre-acquisition or around the time of acquisition, it was quoted as a, you know, relatively small, high conviction active manager with assets of 36 billion and then EOS, you know, with 359 billion under advice. Where today, if I look as of 30th of June, it shows that you have AUM of 507 billion, but then you did mention, you know, less than that. So I just wanted to just double check. And then assets under advice now are double, or more than double actually, at 914.8 billion pounds, right?
So to make things clear, so the first number is just Hermes. The second number is Federated Hermes combined.
Right, combined, yeah. Perfect.
If you look at pure Hermes, I started by saying that as the BT pension scheme matures, it takes out its growth assets. If you look at our third-party assets,
yeah,
third-party assets.
I was going to mention that, yeah.
We went, period when I took over the pre-acquisition, from about zero to about 17 billion. If you look at our income, when I joined there was about 7% of our income was not from the BT pension scheme. Today, more than 80%, 83% is not from the BT scheme. That gives you. So mathematically, we've more than doubled the assets. But at the same time, of course, as the BT scheme matures, it was withdrawing assets and putting them in asset and liability matching assets, which we don't do. That growth is also reflected in the growth of EOS, which, as you say, has more or less doubled now, and we're more than $1 trillion of assets in which we represent. So it's hard to judge, but I would say over the last 8 or 9 years, we have been one of the fastest growing asset managers in the UK, absolutely fastest growing. And the fact that we've maintained a positive momentum, even though we've lost assets to BT, who've put the money in liability matching, actually shows you just how much we've grown, right?
Yeah.
Because once upon a time, when you looked at us and we were 35 billion, that was all BT, right? And now they're a very small part of it. And that is, I'm still a big part, but much smaller than they used to be. And that is the shift that we've seen in the growth of third-party business. In combining with our parent, our combination is much bigger, and our combination together is now growing at more than market is expecting, because of course we have something to offer that the market wants to buy, which is this integrated ESG asset base.
Yeah, and that links nicely with, you know, talking to your customers and growth. You know, so how do you grow that? You know, you have a very strong distribution as well here. That's another conversation, and then combined with the US now, but. What do your clients ask you? You know, what do they come to you, or you know, how do you approach them? You know, it's like, how have you managed to grow in this way?
So I think you again split into three parts, if I may. The first part is, it is clear that with the growth of indexation based on pricing, that the whole middle section of what used to be called active management, which was really just smart beta in disguise, would wither away and die. And that's what happened to a lot of funds in the UK and a lot of asset management houses. Accounts in the UK, and why you've seen some mergers between giants to try to capitalize on the distribution. Within that context, what we have always offered our clients is a differentiation of very high active share. What does very high active share mean? It means very, very different from the benchmark. In other words, even if our clients wanted to buy a benchmark, there's a place for them to buy very different from the benchmark. Why would they want to buy very different from the benchmark? Well, because all academic research that's coming out of the States, particularly about active share, led by Professor Kramer, who's now works for the University of Notre Dame. He's dean of the business school there, and he's been working on this for some years now, shows that high active share managers, even the ones who are not that skilled, outperform benchmark and everybody else after fees from that position. So what we offered is a unique high active share. People use the word alpha. I don't like the word alpha. It's value. And we measure everything, by the way. I didn't mention this, but I mentioned we pay half our bonuses on being nice. The other half for the fund managers is not just do you beat the benchmark. It's over a long time period, adjusted for risk and information ratio, after fees. Mm-hmm. Your client gets the money after fees, right? And that's what you should get back. So anyway, so we offer them this high active share that then allows us to integrate ESG. So we have a whole bunch of clients who basically come to us because they're looking for pure skill. 6 years ago, 7 years ago, they weren't really interested in the ESG. They were just buying the skill. And the conversation went like this. We want to buy your emerging market fund or whatever, your property fund. And we'd say, absolutely. And they'd say to us, we'd like it because the numbers are so strong. And they'd say, why are the numbers strong? And we'd say, because we integrate ESG. And they say, that can't be right because surely you're giving up performance. We'll say, you know, you've got the numbers. So you judge. And that's changed now, where we've seen people coming to us and say, we are looking for ESG. So that's one shift that's happened in the marketplace. The other thing that's happening in the marketplace is the growth of indexation. And the history of Hermes was that it launched an index fund back in 1985.
Right.
And I think at the time there was only one other index fund, which was the Vanguard index fund, $500 million. And very quickly, the CEO at the time of Hermes, which was then called Postel, found out very quickly that you lose connection with the companies. So he thought if this grows and this will grow, you have a disconnect between the owners of the companies and the companies they own, right? And that is indeed what's happened with the rise of indexation. Professor John Kay wrote an article a few years back in the FT, and he said that basically, because people don't exercise their ownership of the companies that they own, they have disenfranchised themselves so that they become coupon clippers. That's all that the share is. It's basically a coupon clip. And the ownership rights then devolve to the CEOs, which can't be right because the CEOs don't own the companies, right? And the CEOs, by definition, do not have the same long-term horizons that the owners will have. And so to meet that, we invented this idea of engagement. Mm-hmm. And this idea of engagement was not just that you vote. That is not engagement. That's just mechanical. The idea of engagement was that you concentrate on companies that you're going to be in for the very long term. And you explain to them that you have them in an index fund, for example. You also do it for active funds, but you explain to them you're in an index fund, which means you're never going to get rid of them. And you say, so we're in this for the next 15, 20 years, 30 years together. So let's talk to each other about how we can help you, the company, become better over the 30 years, not worry about the next quarter. And part of what we bring to the table is people who've been in the industry, who can negotiate and talk about the sectors, people who've been on boards and have been in executives. And what we can bring to the table as well is comparatives. We can bring examples of other companies in the same sector and what best practice looks like and help companies get better. And that business has grown for us because, of course, indexation grew inevitably because the price for the smart beta was too high. And so people went for indexation, which is possibly better value than smart beta. And as that happened, there's a realization now, starting in the Nordics, but spreading through the rest of the world, that if you have that, you've got to engage because otherwise you don't control your ownership. And these two pillars have been the main pillars of what we offer to our clients. Now, our clients essentially are institutional clients or wholesale clients. We don't do individuals as individuals, not for anything, but it's not our business model. Our parent does much more wholesale than we do, but essentially that's the two things that we do. We've seen a shift more towards responsible investment. We've seen a massive shift towards people acknowledging that stewardship and engagement is a necessary part of fund management going forward. And we remain the pioneers and the leaders in this. We have more than 60 people working in our responsibility and stewardship business, which is a huge team. And $1 trillion is a lot of money, by the way. And we approach it, again, differently. We concentrate on what our clients want to talk about. And we also do stewardship for funds, which we actively manage and integrate that into active management. So we do something different from other active managers. We not only talk normally to companies, but we also put in the 20-year horizon. Now the question is, okay, all that is great. What does it do? So active management, I think, there has been an acceptance that academic work shows that it outperforms. We have our own academically sponsored work that shows the ESG factors outperform. We've been measuring them since 2007, by the way. And certainly the G outperforms. And the S, we think, outperforms quite a lot. And the E does, but the E needs more time and data. So there is value being added in that. Now, interestingly, we also measured or had academics come out independently and measure how the performance of our stewardship business is. And that has been the most extraordinary. Because looking over time with companies that we've engaged with over a long period of time, right? We found that the companies we've engaged which have listened to our suggestions have substantially outperformed other companies in the same sector, in the same market. So clearly, that also adds value. And that goes back to right the beginning of our discussion. When I said to you, on a micro level, stock by stock, actually integrating ESG is simply a better way of investing. And doing stewardship is a better way of enhancing value over the long term. And it all comes back to this concept that actually doing the right thing, being good, is simply good business.
Yes, and I did say at one time in another interview as well that by integrating ESG, the alpha is much better, even though you mentioned that you don't like it as much. To talk about it, and it's interesting to think now. So because as you were speaking, I was thinking as a CEO of a competitor, or, you know, as you look at the market and other threats, you know, to your business, you know, with passive investors, or, you know, the growth of ETFs, or, you know, the challenges to the pricing and the costs, etc. You know, because I was going to ask you about your vision and your growth goals, but, you know, with everything you say, it's clear to me, and I don't mean to answer for you, please add, you know, but it's clear to me that all these threats basically are threats in certain respects, but basically they're talking to different clients. So your clients, you know, are, you know, clients that have a specific profile, which is this kind of long-term view with a wider effect on society. So almost by default, you know, there's only one place, in this case, you know, one place to go to, which is your house.
I think, yes. And I think we also attract people who just want our performance. I mean, it's quite interesting. We have people come to us just because the performance is good. And that's also good, right? And we say that's fine. I think, look, the whole thing about ETF and ESG, ETFs and index funds, and now there are ESG ETFs as well.
Yeah.
I think people have
to be launched now, right now, yeah.
Think about why you're buying an index. You're buying an index because you're buying a market, okay? That's just betting on directionality. I understand why people want to do it, but I'm absolutely convinced that the trend is that it will become almost impossible for people to invest in index without investing in stewardship. And if you look at the largest index provider in the world, they also have got a stewardship business that they're building fast because they recognize that. Now, ultimately, that means that the price of index goes up, by the way. I worry slightly that as ESG becomes a trend, it becomes a label. And if it becomes a label, it becomes, you know, I can tick these five boxes and then I am doing something. We struggled for a long time about whether we should call any of our funds ESG. And in fact, we decided not to. We have three called ESG because specific clients that we run the money for asked us to call it that. But we don't want to. Why did we struggle with that? Because we think this is just investment. Mm-hmm. And I worry about people launching things called ESG as if ESG is something out here and the rest of the world is down here. And this is the same silo mentality that says the financial system is here, the economic system is here, and then society is here. And what we say in our investment is all one. That's how we started this conversation
yeah. In
the beginning. It's all one. And that's where I worry about things like an ESG ETF. What does that mean? That means you're ticking up boxes. And by the way, you make the most amount of money if you buy something which is not good at the ES or the G and improves it. Because like in any other business, the delta of improvement is the source of our performance.
Inefficiencies, yeah. Yeah. And on the back of that, I think maybe it's a good time to perhaps talk about kind of identifying and measuring, you know, ESG, being impact, be, you know, what is it that you focus on, you know, especially even on the engagement side, which, you know, is something so long-term.
So we've been thinking about this for a long time. And I think the easy measurement is to measure financial returns. And that we can show now correlation. But we are not quite comfortable with financial returns because we think there are other things that you should be measuring. And that's all the, you mentioned at the beginning that I'm part of IIRC, which is the Integrated Reporting
Council. Yes.
So what's that trying to do? That's trying to say that we should have much more integrated reports and accounts for companies that go beyond simply the financials. So yes, the financials are the easy way to measure the efficacy of ESG, but to us, it's not good enough. It needs to go further. And we don't know the answer. We're working on it. I mean, where we differ from others, others say to you, this is what we do. What I say to you is we spend a huge amount of time and effort and thought in trying to develop what the market thinks. I mean, we treat it almost like an academic exercise, right? And we're constantly not satisfied and we're constantly trying to innovate and come up with a better understanding, not a better product, that's just selling, but a better understanding of how the system works. So we want to try to measure holistic return and we're working on that. But we think it is something to do with long-term return and the impact on the wider community of where your investment is. In terms of what makes ESG, you know, can I say that this is good governance or this is bad governance or this is good sustainability, this is bad sustainability? Kind of, but it's very nuanced. And people miss the nuance. Now, in normal investment speak, if we're just doing a normal investment in a normal company, it is not controversial to say, yeah, I mean, you know, growth is growth, but there is a nuance of understanding where the growth comes from. When we talk about ESG factors, however, it seems like the market wants to have a specific box that they want to put everything into it rather than the nuance. And I think that that is not exactly useful because it's the nuance of the differentiation of what sustainability means, what governance means, and how it can change over time that actually adds value in reality. So it becomes more ephemeral. It's like it ultimately manifests itself in culture. Mm-hmm. And the culture is the hardest to measure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you mentioned the IIRC, and I think that you mentioned at one point in a recent video that you did on the importance of this single standard, you know, for reporting. Mm. I just want to double check with you, perhaps, what is it that would make it happen that we can achieve this single standard?
So that is an interesting one. So if you go, I mean, I did history, so I always do history, right? Mm-hmm. If you go to why we have gap accounting, because there wasn't a standard of accounting and the 30s crash happened.
Yeah.
Crash happened. And this Companies Act was passed in the UK and a similar act was passed in the States. What did it aim to do? To give investors a reflection of what's really happening financially in the company. That's how gaps start. Now, by and large, in this modern era, we can get that from accounts. But actually what moves companies is not just the financials, partly because there's a lot of intangible assets in some of the biggest companies. I mean, You know, think about the technology companies as an example. Think about even companies such as our own, where a lot of the intangible assets is in the brand and the reputation, right? So how do you measure the non-financial aspects that matter as much for the financial results? And the whole thing, again, you mentioned I'm on the banking standards board, the BSB. That's talking about culture in banks. Now, culture in banks mattered because culture in banks was identified as one of the reasons that the banks behaved in a way that caused the ruckus of 2008.
Yeah, not all fair, yeah.
So how do you measure it? And clearly it's as important, if not more important, than financials. And I think there is a growing agreement and understanding among the investment community that these other items have to be looked at. The key is to get to a consensus where we move and say we want integrated reporting rather than just simply financial reporting. And we in Federated Hermes UK have been doing that for some time, and we've been improving our integrated reports and accounts, and we're trying to talk about culture, and we're trying to talk about impact and about us as a company, because what is our business? I start off by saying our business is a people business. Well, okay, you can look at the financials, but that doesn't tell you where the risk and the reward is going to be. That's much more in other things that we do.
Yeah. And how far are we, do you think, of achieving something that...
So we're still some way off. I mean, I think we're coming closer in that the consensus is growing, but that takes time.
Any particular blockers or any particular things that would help?
I think two blockers. The one is to agree one way of doing it, because people like to have one way of doing it. If you go back to the Companies Act, that was an act of government. So people had to do it. So if the regulator comes in and says, you've got to do this, that removes a block of people doing it voluntarily. And the other one is to come at a standard. I'm less concerned about the standard. People really get worried about it because you have more than one gap, right? You have UK gap and US gap. When I started, it was even more varied than it is now. It's coming closer together. So as long as there's at least within a region an agreement of what such reports should include.
One, two. Okay. And I guess, you know, the EU is kind of helping and somehow, you know, putting us ahead in Europe, yes, at least, right?
So the EU seems to be accelerating a trend much more than anywhere else in the world, both in integrating responsibility and in pushing towards this concept in accounting, which is slightly more different, because I think they think it's quite rightly a better way of understanding business.
Yes. And we have still quite a few actually questions that I wanted to ask you, but you know, I'm conscious of time as well for you, for ourselves and for the listeners. And I may actually mention that in this case, I may break this one in a couple of different episodes so that people get the chance to enjoy it in shorter versions. But very quickly, talking now about perhaps reporting at the company level, which sometimes we don't talk about too much. And, you know, we were at that event on the summer, which was the Real Impact Tracker event, the soiree. And you, for those that do not know, and for self-disclaiming, Real Impact Tracker, you know, we are partners with them and with Kari Krasinski, one of the advisors, ILIM partners. But you actually had their assessment done and their rating done, your company, and you achieve the highest score in the history of the certification. And this is an independent certification that says, that measures, you know, how impactful you are as an entity, right? How important is to do this for companies, you think, and to start with?
So there are two answers to this as well. Let me start with where we left off, which is talking about reports and accounts. So one of the ways in which one is assured, and there's been some discussion of this, or in theory, an investor is assured that the accounts are true and fair reflection, is to have an auditor audit them. There've been some questions about auditors recently, but in general, that is the safety measure. That is the way that you ensure that the truth is being said. And I think companies should also be audited for what they say, particularly now. So everybody now says that the ESG and impactful and integrated. Okay, who audits it? Because, you know, I can start a company and say we're the most impactful ESG integrated, and I can have really nice websites. So the importance of an independent audit for the consumer, for the underlying beneficiary whose money is going to be used, is deeply important. But equally, it's important for us who actually use the service. Because unless you go into self-reflection, and unless you try to work out where you're weak and where you're strong, you can't move forward. Now, we were incredibly proud and pleased that we were chosen with such a high rating. We really were. And it was an amazing boost for us, and we're very thankful for it, but we're not sitting on our laurels. We're very humbled by it. But in a way, we want to keep on testing ourselves, because we do this because we believe it's the best way of doing what we do. And we need to check ourselves to make sure that we're constantly improving what we do. So that's why it's also important for business reasons and as well as for the client or the underlying beneficiary.
Excellent. And I do recommend people to go and look at the report. I will add the link to the notes of the podcast. But in essence, you know, it does look at different areas in terms of, you know, how you perform, how you're perceived by externally, how you, you know, integrate ESG. So it's quite a few areas that it reviews so that, you know, there is this independent party view of how you behave effectively, right?
Exactly.
And yes, as we mentioned, you know, you happen to receive the highest rating and, you know, they have done this on a few entities. You can do it at all entity level, and then you can do it also sometimes at just fund specific levels, which is, you know, an option that you can have. But anyway, congratulations. And it's nice to see that being you through engagement, through your services, sometimes being the third party, you know, and working with others to make them better, that you also, you know, take action to work with third parties to, you know, check that you're doing the right thing.
Exactly. And as I say, we're very, very pleased and grateful for the rating, and we will continue to try to improve ourselves. It humbles us.
Very nice. So now, as we are wrapping up the conversation, you know, if we talk about, you know, the future and, you know, what it brings to us, you know, in potentially in the market, you know, in sustainable investing in general, and then perhaps more specifically to you, you know, given all the recent events, you know, and everything that's happening, what do you think it would be? And I always ask this question around kind of scalability, you know, and acceleration. You know, I think that kind of key. So how do we scale sustainable investing? How do we transition more capital? Sorry, this is becoming a long question now, but you know, I bring in maybe the comment here. You know, sometimes we were at that event and there was this individual, I remember, challenging you on the chat box saying, you know, how come can you get this rating if you still hold investment in fossil fuels? And, you know, and I know that you don't like divestment, but, you know, there's all this conversation around, you know, how do we transition? You know, we still need to fund some sectors. We still have, and we didn't talk about this, but you were a participant with Mark Campanale, you know, pushing the agenda around carbon tracking and the thesis of, you know, that we're completely overinvested and we're never going to get all the resources out. And then at the same time, you know, we still don't have in the pipeline companies or maybe enough supplementary or products and services and companies that can replace the ones that we have today. So it's so complex, right? And people have said, and now I understand people can, without understanding the whole spectrum and how the whole supply chain and all the stakeholders, so easy to point the finger and say, you know, you're getting the top rating, but you're still, you know, investing in stranded assets. And, you know, you're saying this, but you're doing that. And then at the same time, you know, a lot of people are still trying to learn, you know, how to do it. So, sorry, this was a very, very long question now, but what do you think, you know, is it can help us transition and, scale faster?
Let me start with the carbon investments and then work backwards, because actually it exemplifies the issue. And for a while, I was the chairman, by the way, of Carbon Tracker, which is Campanelli's outfit. And I was involved with the Vatican's bringing together the captains of all the oil majors to come to this agreement about pricing carbon that happened in the Vatican last summer, not the summer, the one before. So what is it that we're trying to do? So you can take two positions. I'm describing not passing a value judgment. One position is to say, global warming is a clear and imminent danger. I will personally not buy that share because it has carbon assets. The problem is, we started off by talking about indexation. The company exists and is still producing carbon. So what you're doing is you're feeling good about yourself. I'm doing the right thing. But actually, you're not solving the problem. To solve the problem, you need to do three things. One, you need to convince the company to either close down or change its business model. Two, you need to find an alternative source of whatever the company does. And three, you've got to convince the consumer to actually shift their consumer patterns. And all three are necessary if you're really trying to change the final outcome. One on its own is not going to work. So if we do own fossil fuel companies, generally speaking, we tend to own and encourage ones that shift from oil to gas. Now, gas is still burning carbon, but it's cleaner than oil. And we're encouraging them to go from gas to other, be it solar, be it wind, be it any other. That's one. And at the same time, we're encouraging manufacturers of cars to move to EV cars because that is a cleaner way of work. But that's only part of the problem. You've only changed one bit. We work and advocate with the regulators to make city centers, and you've seen this increasingly in Europe, in the UK, more EV focused, more pedestrian focused, less fossil fuel car focused. Okay, so you've dealt with that. You still haven't dealt with the rest of it. You have the whole thing about, for example, fast fashion. Fast fashion eats up a huge amount of carbon emissions, right?
Yeah, and water, yeah.
That's a whole thing of a discussion with consumers about how to change consumer behavior. And we started again this conversation saying, through our savings, we impact the world that we live in by what we buy. Well, actually, we do also by our spending patterns.
Right, yeah.
We should question ourselves and our neighbors. So what we do is advocate. If you look at our pledge, our oath, by the way, it says, I will advocate. What are we do? So do you, you know, if you drive, do you bicycle? If you don't bicycle, do you drive an electric car? Why not? Right? I mean, that's the first bit of advocating. Do you look at where your clothes are made? Are you sure that they're low impact rather than high carbon impact clothing? Carbon emissions from global trade is actually quite massive. Now, it turns out if you have manufacturing facilities in each region, actually you bring this down somewhat. How much are we working on it? And how much are we investing in alternative visions and technologies? You've got to do all of these things to move the dial. So we're not interested in virtue signaling. Virtue signaling is great, but actually we're interested in something more. In this, and forgive me, this is going on a personal level, I bring something from my own faith. So I'm a Muslim, and Muslims have, like Christians, like Jews, like others and Hindus, we have various practices. But we say in our faith that fasting is the practice that matters the most. And the reason is this, that if you go to the mosque or the church, people see you, right? So I'm a good churchgoer. I go to the synagogue every Saturday. My community sees me. But actually, I can say to you, I'm fasting, but I could be drinking my Coke. Nobody sees me. There's no virtue signaling.
Yeah. You do it
yourself. And to my mind, trying to change things is about change, not about virtue signaling. So that's the first point. The other point is change happens over time. It doesn't happen suddenly. You reach a tipping point and then the tipping point goes. When Campanelli started, I remember going to the Bank of England and meeting with Mr. Andrew Haldane, who I have a huge amount of respect and time for, huge amount. And he understood what we were saying, but in our first meeting, he wasn't convinced it was a financial matter. He thought it was much more a societal matter. Now, he looked at it and he's changed his mind and he's moved markets to change their mind. If you look at responsible investing, Professor Kay has moved to a position which is close to what we believe in. So what's happening? What's happening is that actually we're beginning to have societal movement. And if you look at generations, the younger generation, not my age, but my daughter's ages, are much more concerned about these issues of fast fashion versus not fast fashion and making a change with their consumer behaviors and meat versus not meat. I mean, again, meat is a big reason why we have And suddenly you have a societal move. So to change things, you need it all to come together. And this idea that you can just do it by saying, oh, we'll solve the problem by producing a better battery for electric cars or an all that, that's just one of it. But you've got to do it all. And you've got to realize it's a long, long slog.
Yes.
The good thing is, as a society, COVID has taught us that when these events happen, when these extreme events happen, they can whack society in a major way. So suddenly people are getting more worried because we've seen what COVID did to us. We all had to lock ourselves up in our houses. The changing pattern of weather is beginning to worry people now. Insurance companies are beginning to worry about insuring buildings and businesses next to waterways and next to the seas. And people are beginning to openly talk about, if we don't do something about this, then there will be entire cities that disappear underwater. I mean, if this is unmitigated and we end up at 3 degrees, there are some projections that show cities as varied as Alexandria in Egypt and New York, which loses a big chunk of it to the sea. Right? And why should we care because we can always build other cities? We should care because it impacts our lives. Do you remember I went to Adam Smith?
Mm-hmm.
To think of this, why in Europe particularly we should care. Next to us is North Africa. And North Africa is full of very young people. And right now, North Africa is the precarious tilt of being able to feed itself. And same with the whole of Africa. We saw the massive migration that happened to Europe. And look at the destruction it did and the disruption it caused. Now, if we have water rising, if we have 2 degrees, then the Delta region in Egypt gets flooded. There's 100 million people who live in that country, and they're not going to have enough food. We saw what happened when the lakes in Central Africa dried up and the migration that came up to North Africa and then through that to the rest of Europe. It is in our interest on all levels to actually deal with this danger. The problem has always been it's long term and people have delayed trying to deal with it.
Yeah.
Or they want a solution which is a one pill solution. You do this and it's solved. That's not how the world works. You've got to do a little bit at a time. That's what we believe in. Little changes at a time that make sense to everybody, and you've got to be long-term. The good thing about COVID is it showed you if you don't do something, actually the results can be pretty harsh.
Indeed, indeed. So we have the last 3 minutes, and I didn't want to go away without just asking a question about you. And interesting, you mentioned the point about being a Muslim as well. And I realize, which is an interesting information and fact, you know, that you were born into the oldest Muslim dynasty in Jerusalem. And, you know, your family has for centuries been official guardians of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is the site of Christ's tomb, which is, you know, I think is extremely interesting. And I'm a Christian, which is, you know, but it's interesting to see the relationship. And just funny enough, just a comment to you is that I have been appreciating fasting, you know, for the first time. I did my first 3-day fasting last weekend. It's all around understanding and a lot more factors than just the fact of doing it itself. You know, it has to do with patience, with cleansing, and everything is, like you say, on closed doors. But obviously now I made it official. But it was a quite an interesting experience, which I'm looking forward to developing. But on this point about, you know, your religion and, you know, everything you have done, and obviously you have done a lot of actions, you know, that perhaps people don't see, you know, like sitting and going and with Mark talking to the Bank of England, and obviously, you know, the sum of all of these, you know, in a way it can be reflected on your CBE. If you had to share one habit, you know, that you have, you know, as an individual that you do maybe daily, what would that be?
So I try to judge myself and whether I've done that which is right. I genuinely do not think that success is money or position or title. I think success is helping others. After all, I was born in Jerusalem and I walked in the same street that Christ walked in. Who remembers the name of the richest man who lived in Rome or Judea 2,000 years ago? Who cares? What importance was their achievement? Or the biggest trading empire? Or the biggest philosopher? People who impact communities, societies, the world, are people who change the world for better, ultimately. The story of actually the development of even Western capitalism is the story of trying to make the world better for everybody, taking it out from feudalism, something which wealth is much more distributed. And a lot of what we think today is woke was practiced in the 19th century by more enlightened people like the Cadburys and the Tates.
Mm-hmm.
So what I try to always say to myself is I've been given privileges of education, of wealth, of position, of knowledge, of contact with marvelous people that I can learn from. That's all good for me. What have I done to give back? And I stated earlier that it's not just writing a check. That is the easy way out. What have I really done to make an impact? Because I firmly believe we receive what we have in trust. Whether you believe in God, so it's in trust from God, or whether you believe in nature, so it's trust from nature or from the universe. It doesn't matter. And we're here on this earth for 60, 80 years, 90 years. And then we pass on. And we have to pass it on to the next generation. And I will end this with a story, which I love, because taking care of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre shows that the closeness we have, or I have, between my faith and the Catholic faith, at least, or the Christian faith. But there's one that we share with the Jewish faith. And it's a story that both the Jewish history has and we have in my part of the world. And the story is that an old man is planting an olive tree. And in the Jewish tradition, a centurion, in ours, a Persian prince, comes and says, "Old man, why do you bother?" Because olive trees, when you plant them, take at least 7 years to start producing olives, as anyone from you know, and it takes much longer before it's fully producing. And the man looks at the young person asking the question as if they're completely dead. He says, "Well, look, the reason we manage to eat is because past generation planted. So I plant so that future generations may eat." This idea of trust, we have something given to us and we have to give back. And so what I do to myself every day is I know I've not done what I should do. And I ask myself, have I done the best that I could in giving something back in what I do? Not just in this, in my work, with my family, in my community, in my friends. Have I made the world slightly better than I came into it? Because if I haven't, then I have had been no value add over the time. That's all that I do.
Yeah, yeah, I like that. Thank you so, so much. How can people get in touch with you, Saka, if they need to?
So they can get in touch with me on my LinkedIn account, and I generally accept people on LinkedIn, so that's easy. Or they can write to me at my email account at work, and I respond to people who write to me. I'm very open, by the way.
That was wonderful. Thank you so, so much, Saka. It was a real honor, and thank you for everything that you do, and including today's episode with us. I'm sure that is, you know, it's going to add a lot of value to a lot of people as well. So really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you having me. Thank you. Take care.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your time, everyone. And it's until the next episode of Impact Leaders, and God bless you all. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Impact Leaders. Impact Leaders is brought to you by ILM Partners and Fast Forward 2030. Please connect with us at ILM Partners for advice on how to transition into sustainable and impact investing. And go to fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models.